From 3Lakes1.com, this is the Debrief Podcast. I'm Josh Durso, and I'm joined today by Jackie Augustine. We're back, and we are here doing this all over again. It's been a couple weeks, but there has been a lot of different stuff that's gone on.
Definitely a lot of stuff.
How you feeling?
I'm doing well, but I'm wearing like a sweater, and you've got a fleece on, and it's May, so I suppose we could be better.
It doesn't feel like spring. The calendar says spring,
in the finger legs.
But it doesn't. Yeah. It doesn't want to yet.
The sun's out, so that's great.
But we do have some breaking news, some new-ish news. Let's talk about that. So City Council last night, Geneva City Council, it looks like we finally have a city councilor in a seat that had been obviously left vacant after the passing of a former city councilor.
Yes. So last week, when we last left off, it has turned into a saga. So last week, as most people know, council deadlocked. They couldn't figure out who to appoint to the seat. It broke down. I would say it broke down across party lines. It broke down what I call the functional party lines, meaning the way people actually are versus the way they're actually registered. So,
Which is a weird, that is a really weird delineation to create.
It is, I mean that, but that's how local politics goes, right? People are registered Democrat, but they always vote Republican values, vice versa. People register Republican and they vote the Democrats. So you never can tell. But Geneva City Council's become very predictable. So the Republicans at heart voted for their candidate who's going to be on the ballot in the fall, and the Democrats at heart and in registration voted for the candidate that is on the ballot for them.
And that is Edith?
No, that was Juanita Akins.
Okay.
And John Pruitt. Those are the two candidates that are going to face off in November for the Ward 6 seat. The difference, kind of the wild card in this, is that local people decided, go figure, to do what city council should have done, which is go into Ward 6 and ask people who they would like appointed as the interim councilor until the election in November and then the swearing in January. And overwhelmingly, by more signatures than there were votes cast for prior city council people for that seat, the ward wanted Juanita, which makes perfect sense because she is the leader of the East Lakeview neighborhood group, the current leader, and has been really active in the community. So that didn't really come as a surprise. What came as a surprise was one city councilor saying and repeating last night that he doesn't care what people think or how many people support somebody. He's going to do what he wants. And then that's our new deputy mayor. And then another councilor, again, who's registered Democrat, but that doesn't mean anything to her, said she already pledged her support to John Pruitt a long time ago, and she didn't realize that there was going to be another candidate, which, although she voted that Republican Party line, she didn't get the narrative right because the Republicans have been saying, oh, well, we thought it was Juanita all along until we got a candidate. It's just no one, when you're so embroiled in trying to cover your tracks, they start being unable to keep their own story straight. So we've been trying to follow it. But what it comes down to is it was a 4-4 vote, which means that the resolution fails for both candidates. So at the end of the meeting, there was some discussion and talk about Edith Wormley, who had been the East Lakeview neighborhood leader and was on the comp plan, was a school board member, who everybody who's active in the community knows, except apparently most of our city councilors. But again, we've already established that they're not the most connected group. She indicated that she'd be interested in serving the interim position just to make sure the seat didn't stay empty, because it's insulting. They kept saying, don't worry, residents of Ward 6, we're representing you, which
we know isn't true.
Well, I mean,
let's just call a spade a spade. A part-time elected official does not have does not just magically have more time on their hands.
Yeah, let me double my constituent base and offer the same service. Right. That's a good point. But also, what's the point of having ward counselors at all if your proposition is that actually anyone anywhere in the city provides equal representation? I mean, that just doesn't make sense. Then do away with ward counselors and just say it doesn't matter. But that's not true. It does matter. So that's if you're going to do it away with anybody, I mean, I think the at-large representatives, if you were trying to pare down council, I'm not saying the current at-large representatives, but anyway, tangent. So they ended up, well, they didn't want to appoint Edith that night because they needed to stick to their process, which was laughable because everything that has happened with Geneva City Council has been basically the dictionary exhibit of anti-process. Like, they can't, there is nothing.
I'll just throw this in there. It has been my experience covering local boards in general that process is very rarely stuck to.
Right.
And it's very difficult for those boards to stick to process, I think partly because of the constraints of what they're doing and the way their boards and their entities are organized. But that's a separate debate.
That is generous and charitable of you to say that that's the reason. I don't want to be a cynic.
I think that's the broad reason. If you have to put a reason on why all of them fail universally at being as objective and process-driven as they should be, I think that's the generic sort of applies to all reason. I don't think you have broken people in broken communities everywhere. I do want to, of course, there are exceptions to that rule. And I think the cynic that you're about to talk about is completely understandable in the Geneva application, given what we've seen historically.
Well, and let me pepper it with a little bit of optimism, because I'm always an optimist, that it could get better, right? There is a path forward. But a process begins with being able to articulate the purpose of the process. And that's what was missing. Nobody on council, I won't say nobody, very few people on council, and certainly not the counselors that get usually listened to by the other louder mouths, was able to say, this is what we're trying to achieve, which should have been good representation for Ward 6. Instead, they were like, well, it's politics. This is how it goes. There's always going to be this jockeying. No. No, it's going that way because you have failed to have a process. You could say our objective is to fill the seat responsibly and in keeping with the wishes of the ward, which is overwhelmingly Democrat and has overwhelmingly supported one particular person. But that would have been too reasonable. So now we end up in this other thing. So last night, without providing Edith Wormley any forewarning, without inviting her to the meeting, which every time someone's appointed to city council, and this has happened before, it's not like this is totally new, right? First time it's happened, well, no, it's not the first time it's happened in Ward 6, but it's the first time it's happened in a while in a ward that they don't take as seriously. I mean, let's just be honest. That's what's happening here. So every other time, the person is in the audience because you are immediately sworn in. When you fill a vacancy, you become the counselor, right? You're there. So they were having a full meeting discussion of DRI stuff, but they didn't bother to invite her to the meeting so she could come in and take a seat with them. You know, I guess they'll just wait till June. So there are multiple levels of kind of insulting behavior that would not have happened if this were any other ward in the city, if the candidates were not women, if the candidates were not people of color. And I know some counselors are going to take issue with that, but those are the facts. And the facts are they have now mistreated two women of color who are active in the community and have community support, and they gave no reason for what they've done other than, well, that's politics. That's just politics. And nothing anyone says is going to make me think any different. So ultimately, I think, you know, they did appoint Edith, and that's great. That is a win for the 6th Ward because she's going to do an excellent job. And then the election in November will determine who takes the seat permanently in January for a full term. And it just caused unnecessary drama by them hemming and hawing and trying to fight the will of the people.
So I know very little about any of the people or players involved in this particular story, but I have found it very, very interesting that a third party was introduced into the equation after the fact. So now Edith will become and is this vacancy filler.
Right.
So that's really all this person is. This isn't even a person who, in theory, would have a chance to run for another, for that seat permanently?
I mean, that's not her interest either,
right.
But yeah.
Okay. So when we start, so I'm going to backtrack a tiny bit. So that is one concern for me in terms of how well is this person going to be able to effectively carry out process. Someone who doesn't have the, we'll say, institutional knowledge that someone who would have gone at least through part of the process, or someone who's at least interested in running for the vacancy this fall, would have had or would have been bringing to the table. Now, the flip side of that is, and that's all I'm going to say about that particular situation, you mentioned how difficult it is for some boards to be able to stick to a process.
Right.
It's funny. You also, you I think you piggybacked that with it's probably going to get better, or you said you hoped that it was going
it
to get better, for Geneva.
It could get better. Yes.
Okay. I don't think it will.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you don't have, so what is the one thing that maybe would like instill some sort of process or ensure that process is going to happen? Well, you'd have some kind of institutional knowledge, and given the slate of candidates that we have for this upcoming election, it looks like the city council is going to lose, or in theory could lose, north of 50% of its institutional knowledge?
Yes, although some of the knowledge that will be going away is how to do things incorrectly.
Right.
So, I mean, there's that. But I'm not saying, I mean, I guess I would push back. I'm not saying that I think institutional knowledge is important for a good functioning public body. Yes, you want that. In an ideal world, you would have institutional knowledge. But when you are dealing with a highly dysfunctional group, I think that reliance on institutional knowledge goes out the window. And what you really need are people who get it, people who understand that they are there as representatives of the public. They are not there to feed their own ego. They are not there to get a, you know, specialized license plate. They are not there for whatever pats on the back they feel come with, you know, walking through the grocery store, being part of, being in charge. I don't know, telling people where they can park on the street. Like, that is, I think if you get a group of people who say, we are about the people, and then things could change. I would take 9 people who say I'm for the people over one guy saying I don't care how many people come and talk to me, I will not change my mind at all any day of the week.
And
even if that guy's got institutional knowledge, because clearly
right.
He's got the wrong kind.
Yeah, and I think I'm just trying to broaden this out to a point where some of the folks who don't live in Geneva are going to sort of take a little bit from this conversation, because I think, like I said, I think this is a problem that we see replicated in lot of different communities. And I think
Seneca Falls.
It's some of the,
can I talk about Seneca Falls?
Right. I mean, you can use Seneca Falls as a case study. I mean, a lot of the issues that were raised in the 3 separate audit finding reports that came out in the last 60 days or so, a lot of that can be pointed to a lack of institutional knowledge,
right.
A lack of knowledge about how a functional municipality is supposed to actually run, like how it's supposed to look, how
right.
It's supposed to be managed.
Government administration. I mean, Yeah.
That's the part where, you know, and sitting here, and I've interviewed probably 150 different candidates for office at different times.
Yeah.
And the one question, and I've said it before on the show and I'll say it again, the one question I always ask is, what are you most looking forward to doing if you are elected this fall? And undoubtedly, 40 to 50% of those people always say, well, I'm really looking forward to learning about the job. Do not tell me you're going to learn right. about the job after you're chosen to do the job.
Right.
That's, you're playing with real money. You're learning with real, yeah. with people's lives. It right. just doesn't work. Like,
and I don't know what there is to learn about the job. Here's the job. Don't mess up people's lives. Try to make things better. And don't be rude. Right. I mean, like that, if those are the marching orders
Listen,
for any elected position,
if a community were managed properly and people's lives were generally good enough,
mm-hmm.
no one would care if the elected officials were rude. They wouldn't care because they wouldn't have to interact with them. You're interacting with
the clerk. But I would say
clerk.
That you couldn't have that situation if you had rude elected officials, because rude people, I think, make bad choices. But yes, okay, that's my.
You know what
let
I mean?
Me be like, mismanaged
it's
for
a
minute.
It's the you're dealing with the clerks. You're dealing with the people
right.
who are actually running the community on a day-to-day basis. You're not interacting with the policymakers. The policymakers are supposed to be the policymakers. They're not supposed to be anything else.
You know, all of this discussion makes me think, if this doesn't exist, we'd better institute local government staff person appreciation day. Because let's just be honest, whatever municipality you're talking about, if it were not for qualified, caring staff, things would be way worse than they are right now. Because yeah. we have seen how the elected officials mess stuff up. And if unchecked by somebody who's like, mm-mm, you can't do that. Actually, we're going to ignore you because that's wrong. It reminds me of these descriptions of the Trump White House where he's all bluster and people are back there like, okay, well, we're just going to ignore that he said that because that's illegal. And, you know, I think that that is really what's happening at the local government level. You've got people trying to learn the job and then people doing the job. So.
Yeah.
Shout out to municipal staff people who do it right.
Those
most of the time,
real
let's
civil,
not say
civil servants.
Right. Let's not say that there haven't been some staff issues over time too, but for the most part, their hearts are in the right place.
So here's another interesting story. The Wayne Central Board of Education held a fact-finding hearing this week. This is over the attempted ouster of two board members. Who are fighting for their jobs right now. Steve Gallagher and Dennis Landry, they were elected last year. They're accused of overstepping their authority and launching into an investigation into the closure of Free Will Elementary School. They're accused of accessing the building when it was locked, but the two board members contend it was left wide open by the superintendent. The reason why I wanted to talk about this was because I don't know if you saw this or not. This story has been bubbling for the last
No.
few months, right? But the media and public were banned from recording the fact-finding hearing, despite the fact that it was the school board was convening.
Right.
People were allowed inside, but no recording devices. So cell phones, obviously media's cameras, et cetera, that sort of thing. Cell phones were even banned. They had police, they had deputies actually there enforcing
it.
This is insane. Now, the district defends that decision. And
how?
Fine. The board defend it's the decision was defended, and they claimed that because it wasn't a fully sanctioned official meeting that it didn't count and that they didn't open meeting laws didn't apply. Fine. Whatever. That doesn't matter. You have a community that is outraged over this, because this very much feels like if you basically go through the record, these are the two dissenting votes
mm-hmm.
on effectively and otherwise what would be complete yes board.
Right.
Okay. And these were the two people who were elected last year to fill seats that people were particularly frustrated with. So imagine taking this scenario, imagine lifting the sort of broad strokes of this story and plopping it on Geneva, Seneca Falls, or God forbid, a county entity of
right.
some kind. This is crazy. The fact that this was even something from, whether it was legal or not, I think that remains to be seen. But the fact that no one from the PR side of the no one was thinking about that. So how is this going to look, right? Nobody asked that question. What are people going to think if we have armed deputies at the doors and we're telling the media outlets from Rochester that are covering this story, no, sorry, you have to leave your cameras out there. And by the way, you can't bring your cell phones in either. And, oh, we're going to do that with the taxpayers too. Everybody. It is, one, it's a recipe for disaster. Two, the minutes from that session should immediately be released without any hesitation whatsoever. And in my mind, every single critical eye should be on the Wayne Central School District now.
Yeah.
Because it is just, regardless of what you want to call it, the district has failed to properly and openly discuss what is really going on here.
Right.
They have not. They have held a hearing about a month and a half ago. They have now held a fact-finding session, which I'm not really sure what that accomplishes.
Right.
Especially when you're not allowing the public or any actual record-keeping, objective record-keeping agency to see.
Check the facts.
Check the facts.
Yeah.
All of that having happened, I don't see how the school district can come out of this without looking just corrupt.
But
really, really corrupt.
You know, this is what I keep thinking as you're telling this story, which I hadn't heard, so I appreciate you sharing it. You know, who is the school district? Like, what has happened? This complete inversion of power where somehow the board members who represent the public are the enemy of the district?
Well,
like,
they are
the district.
Right. They were brought up on these charges by the board for effectively entering, and this actually happened in September. So probably like 5 or so months after they were elected, because those elections are always held in the spring.
Right.
They entered into this school, which they say was left unlocked. It's been closed. Wasn't being maintained properly. These are the different things that have been coming up and coming out from the two board members. They're saying, well, we went in because we had to.
But wait, they own it. I mean, this is what I don't understand. This would be no different than a city entity. Like, the buck stops, in theory, with the school board. I understand that's not how school boards function in New York State, right? That school boards are mostly a rubber stamp for the administration. But, like, the actual organization of the entity itself is that they are the elected representatives meant to set policy, blah, 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 blah. That also means that they're the fiduciary overseers of things. And buildings are part of your financial portfolio. So I don't understand how a board member could be excluded from seeing a building that they own. Now, granted, maybe there's a process by which they should have requested access and been granted that in a speedy way. It sounds like they were pretty sure that wasn't going to happen if they asked. But I understand that they could make a statement saying, board members can't just wander into the facilities at any time unannounced. That makes perfect sense to me, right? City councilors shouldn't just show up at the wastewater treatment plant and gum up the works. But they should be able to go with 10 minutes notice anywhere they please, because these are city assets. These are school district assets. So I don't really understand on what grounds at all they would be able to remove somebody, and it's very narrow grounds on which they could even chastise someone and say, okay, well, I'm sorry, like, you can't just go into the building anytime. Like, here's the process.
Here's the amazing thing. If I'm just going by what the coverages look like and the stance that the board has taken thus far, I would lean toward a genuine belief that these two individuals will be removed from office within months.
That's ridiculous.
Now, I guarantee you that will result in litigation.
Sure.
Of course, it will be challenged.
Sure.
The district will be sued, I'm sure. All of these things will happen. But I am oddly confident that this is, it might happen that these people very well could be removed from office, and it will be stunning. Like it will defy logic. It won't make sense to anyone. It just won't make sense.
Yeah, what is going on? I mean, people need to pay attention to what's happening in their name and, like, speak out about it. I mean, it sounds like people tried to, this fact-finding thing, but were kept from being fully participating.
Well, and that was
that,
the thing. So this has been blowing up for months now.
Wow.
And there were only about 30 people there yesterday at this meeting. And mind you, when the board held the last hearing and the last school board meeting in March and then in February, it was wildly attended. We're talking like probably close to 100, if not more than 100 people at those meetings. Like, come on, this is...
Right.
And call a spade a spade. You have a session where the press was not allowed to correctly do their job.
Do their job. Right.
The public was not allowed to have full access. You can be there, but if you can't be there, you can't see what's happening. Okay, that doesn't really sound like a real meeting to me. That doesn't really sound like something official to me. But apparently, that's what happened. They encouraged it. The district is the direct result of that 30 person turnout at that meeting yesterday. At that meeting on Tuesday.
Well, you know, this is something that Chip Caprero and I used to talk about back when we had our city council blog.
The blog.
People, when they feel scrutinized, and they know that they probably are doing some stuff they shouldn't be doing, they go into information lockdown. And they make it so difficult for people to access documents, to attend meetings, to speak their mind. I mean, I didn't even mention that last night they... at the city council meeting, they prevented John Pruitt, the guy that they almost appointed to city council, from speaking, right? So, I mean, the idea here is, when did government people, elected officials, get the idea that they could shut down the public and that somehow that's ultimately going to make things better? Like, even if they can't be motivated by doing the right thing, just full stop, don't they even see it's not in their best interest to get people this angry and deny access? That always makes it worse.
The answer: when they realized that they weren't smart enough to control the narrative. To some degree, all of these governing bodies are trying to do that, but they're doing it by cutting off communication instead of doing what most marketing and PR firms do, especially those that are in government crisis management, which some of the folks out there maybe should be thinking about considering.
Right.
They put a narrative out there and they combat the thing that is hurting them with information and words. You don't cut contact. That just creates chaos.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's go back to what you said about people learning about the job. Let me add to my three things about not messing people up and trying to make things better and not being rude. And also say,
don't be a coward. There are some optimistic topics coming up.
Good,
I promise.
Good. But I mean, isn't this what's happening? Like, government is turning into the area where the cowards go, where the people who don't want to say what's on their mind, who don't want to present information, who just want to do their thing and not be challenged. And when you challenge them, they wilt or they hide or they strong arm you in some way. Like, this is not okay. People need to be bold in government and say, you know what? Here is what I'm thinking and here's my evidence for it. And now let's discuss it. You can't just say that's the way it is. You have to have a conversation. But, ugh, people don't know how to conduct themselves.
Okay, so we're going to stay with the school theme. All right, and mm-hmm. I'm going to throw something up on the screen for everybody to look at. Jackie,
Is this the map?
It's a map.
Okay.
So this map that's up on the screen right now, this came from, I found it on Twitter a few weeks ago, came from the New York State Center of Rural Schools. It's an entity that apparently has been releasing some data over the last few weeks some vague sort of points and factoids about right. rural schools. So the backstory on this was I came across this tweet and I was like, oh, this is really cool. So I clicked on the links that they had on their in their Twitter feed, clicked on their website. None of it worked.
Really?
The website's broken. It's been broken for like a month. Like nothing. I've sent them messages, the whole nine yards. Like literally nothing is there. I'm like, oh God, there's this map. And it literally shows basically, as you can see,
right.
you're seeing all the school districts and everything that's in red is a district that's shrinking. Everything right. that's in yellow is a district that's shrinking slightly less. The few little green blurbs that you see are actual growing districts. They're right. very, very few and far between. So since I couldn't access the data that they clearly had mined over the course of what I would assume was months, I had to go through the data. And I pulled up all of the data going back to 1979.
Yeah, I saw that.
So school district growth or shrink rate by enrollment over that period. And now I've thrown up the chart that mm-hmm. I created based on the data that I pulled. Couple quick notes. Only two districts saw a meaningful increase in enrollment out of the dozens that were evaluated in Cayuga, Ontario, Schuyler, Seneca, Steuben, Tompkins, Wayne, and Yates counties. More than 20 schools featured an enrollment decline of more than 40% since 1979, and most districts saw a decline of at least 30%. Some districts, Southern Cayuga, as an example, had a decline of more than 60%.
Yeah.
So I had like a million and two different thoughts after I finished writing the story, and it's actually led me to doing a little more research, and we're going to actually be releasing a series of these style stories with numbers, because one of the things that I was really surprised about was the surprise, right? Like even in these districts where people think that things are good economically, like things are really improving in Geneva. Geneva's like 30% smaller than it was 30 years ago. Like that's great. Auburn, right. that's another one. Like Auburn just won the DRI last year. Like yep. they're on the right path. They had an increase. They were actually the only school in the area that we searched through that had an increase between 2009 and 2019, and that increase was 80 something students.
Right.
We're not talking about like right. a giant number of students here. So as I started to talk to some of these rural superintendents, I really honed in on a conversation or a series of conversations, I should say, that I've had with Steve Zielinski. He's the superintendent down in South Seneca. Mm-hmm. And fascinating, fascinating stuff. I'm going to throw a link to this story and, of course, all the other stories that we're talking about in the show notes today. But there is a real existential crisis going on for these rural districts. And frankly, even for some of the urban districts that we have in the Finger Lakes, like people think of Canandaigua, Geneva, Ithaca, Auburn as right. like thriving, strong, good districts, but they're not. They're a shell of themselves. And it's interesting because I think this is probably the first real good case that I've seen for county-wide districts. And I think just going by the numbers, I can throw them back up on the screen. I mean, if you look at the rate at which some of these have shrunk over the last 30 to 40 years, if you fast forward another 30 or 40 years, they may not exist, some of them. Like, the numbers are that dramatic. And I just don't know that with the move to urban that we're seeing, so the people who are choosing to live in New York, mm-hmm. they're leaving rural places. And if they're not leaving the state, they're going to Rochester. They're going to one of the suburbs of Rochester. They're going to Syracuse or one of the suburbs of Syracuse, et cetera. Like you pick your urban centers around the state. It leaves these districts with very little left to work with and effectively leaves them with the most vulnerable population possible.
Right.
And that I thought was a little heads up. The next piece of data that we're wading through is basically the economic challenge for individuals within these districts and how that number has sort of fluctuated over the years. The problem is it looks like it's going to be kind of tough to find data before 2009 on this, because it doesn't look like it was something that was really considered. Like, for example, a simple question, how many students in said district out of those enrollment figures are eligible for free or reduced lunch?
Right.
And the pretty simple answer to that question is, in most cases, more than half.
Right.
And when you combine that fact with a shrinking population, it doesn't leave a space where that school can do very much at a low cost. Everything is costing more to do for them.
Right.
And how else are they going, you know, Superintendent Zielinski told me explicitly that, you know, the main issue is how do we offer not just the clubs and the sports, they're the things that people think about,
right,
but the extra, not the extracurriculars, but
like enrichment and
your enrichment, the
special
AP,
services,
AP level classes,
right. Yeah.
You know, the things that are going to make students better prepared for that next. And there's a million things that are being offered. And even just, you know, people think, well, in a rural district, you're getting more one-on-one care. Well, class sizes aren't always smaller in these rural districts, too. That's the other little factoid, because you're losing staff, especially between like 2005 and 2012. A lot of these rural districts lost a lot of staff. And these are the kinds of things that pop out when you look at the numbers. And it's just very interesting, because I hadn't really seen the numbers like this before. And I think, judging from the feedback that we've been getting on the story, it doesn't look like many people realize that this is how bad it was.
Well, you know what kind of vector I would be interested in having added to this analysis would be not necessarily... I mean, I understand the free and reduced lunch information is interesting, and I agree with you that it's going to track the way that you're saying it does, because we know, I mean, this has been the economic downturn.
Economically disadvantaged was the term that I was looking for.
Okay.
That's the way the state classifies it.
Right.
They don't actually specifically look at free and reduced lunch. They look at economically disadvantaged.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think we know that that has been the story of our area. And we've seen the population decline numbers just like from the census that go along with that since the 70s. But what I would be interested in seeing is how these numbers track with changes in total assessed value. In taxable assessed value, not total assessed value. Because I think what you're going to see, and I'm using Victor as my predictive model for this, that in places that have had substantial growth in taxable property, you have seen an increase in population, because people who have choices, people who can choose to locate their families in different areas, who have more economic mobility because of the nature of their work, you know, whatever their just economic status, will seek out the places that are growing, which compounds the problem. Whereas if you look at, I mean, for me, this whole chart is an indictment of the property tax driven funding model for school districts. I think it's the most ridiculous system ever invented. Because basically what happens when a region takes an economic downturn, property values either stagnate or sink. We've seen that. I mean, look at, there's growth around the country in housing. We never had that bubble, like which is great. We didn't have a bubble, right? But it's not good in that people are not earning the kind of equity on their investments that they might otherwise get if they owned a house somewhere else. So, but then the property taxes being the primary source of revenue for not only municipal operations, but for school districts, ends up being like a double whammy for distressed communities, because now they have potentially higher need students with not enough increase in tax base, and then these additional pressures to try and stay to a level that would attract new residents. And for me, this is about the taxation policy. That, I mean, that is what I see when I look at this, because Victor has had, and the Victor School District includes some Farmington. I guess Farmington's split between Canandaigua and Victor District.
It's mostly, it includes most of Farmington. And that is one of the things, talking to people in Western Ontario County, the growth of that 332 corridor heading west, and then that part of 96 heading into Victor, that is probably the most clear driver of their increase, which, and this is not to, you know, you talk to people in schools and they're looking at this from a perspective of, we're doing the most we can with how little we have, and short of correcting or making these rural communities more economically viable, which I'm not sure is going to happen in the near future, it sort of seems apparent that there's a realization among leaders and among people who just work in schools that eventually we're going to get to a place where large-scale mergers have to happen.
Well, and, but again, that's because state funding, which augments the property tax collection, is on a per-pupil basis. So again, here's additional resources for the already well-resourced districts, and what ends up being a penalty on shrinking districts because they no longer bring in the same amount of state aid if their enrollment numbers drop. So what the state should really be doing, if anyone cared, if county governments cared to lobby for this, you know, other than just focus on the areas that are doing well but actually take seriously the rest of their counties, what they would do is put some, they would change the metric. State funding would go to the highest need districts as a proportion of their tax exempt or their taxable assessment loss, and not on this per pupil basis. Everybody is approaching this problem with an old mindset that doesn't work. And it's frustrating because looking at the data and correlating these various variables tells a story about what needs to be fixed, but it would change so many things about how we currently do stuff that people are just like, well, that's too much.
Here's my issue with just addressing the funding, and I agree that the funding is definitely part of what needs to be fixed. You're not changing the fact that these districts are losing enrollment by the year. I don't know that fixing the funding is going to matter much, because I don't think the state's going to have to worry about funding some of these districts in 10 or 15 years.
Well, okay, I see what you're saying.
You know what I mean? Like, you're running towards the cliff, and I understand, like, the model needs to be fixed, and it would be better for everybody, but if it's not economically viable for a family of four to live in Interlaken or in Bloomfield, they're just not going to live there.
I agree with you, but I don't think it's an either or. Yes, you're going to have some districts that are kind of beyond the tipping point, but you are also going to have, I mean, don't underestimate the motivation of parents who want things for their kids. If schools started, if there were more funding to keep or increase specialized programs, that becomes something that people seek out a community for, right? So, it, like, let's say, I mean, looking here, well, I don't want to keep going back to Victor, but it's such a clear example in our area, right? Victor puts in a $14 million athletic aquatic center, right? People start saying, man, those are nice facilities. I want my kid to be able to participate in those. Maybe we start looking at moving toward the Victor area. Maybe we want to get into that school district. How many realtor signs in suburban Rochester say, live here, get into this district? So housing choice for families is driven a lot by school district.
Okay, so I think this is another interesting topic that we're kind of going to bleed into, but we'll probably save for another show.
Okay.
But I think if you look at Victor, more of the people who are moving to Victor are moving away from Rochester. or they're choosing Victor because the other suburbs of Rochester are at capacity.
Okay,
or the, the housing market in those places is, speaking from personal experience, it's a nightmare right now.
Right.
That is, I think, probably one of the bigger drivers, especially when, you know, when you every now and then you'll see a story. I remember about a year ago we saw the story about the tax issue in Victor where there was the miscalculation.
Right.
And tax, there was like a 20 or 30% tax increase suddenly. And a lot of the feedback you heard from people was, well, I moved away from X suburb of Rochester to Victor because of the low taxes.
Yeah.
And I think what we're seeing is while we're seeing people move toward urban centers like Rochester, we're seeing the ring, that second ring of what's considered or what was considered a suburb, jut out a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And places like, and that's why I thought it was really interesting that a place, a community like the school district, Gananda, mm-hmm. was another one that saw a significant increase over the last 30, 40 years. I think that's because of its placement and proximity to Rochester.
Yeah, definitely.
And, you know, there again, it's one of those scenarios where, huh, you have these different forces at play, and it is super, super complicated, and I actually am going to take your little tidbit of advice there and go after the changes in taxable assessed value in these properties or in these communities. But it's very, very interesting. I think the first thing that has to be dealt with is the sheer loss of students.
Yeah.
Like some of these districts, and honestly, maybe countywide districts wouldn't be the worst thing in the world in some cases, especially in some of these more rural communities. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm looking at like Schuyler County, Seneca County, Yates County. They all have four or fewer schools. I mean, each 4, 2, and 2, they could all easily be managed under one roof. And in
fact,
they think,
seems like, I mean, certainly I'm for neighborhood schools. I don't like these big centralized campuses. Like, I mean, I think that is a serious drawback of Victor, but apparently I'm in the minority on that. But anyway, you know, I think that, but when you're talking about administration, you're right. I don't think there's something so unique. Okay, that's going to come off the wrong way. Well, let me say it anyway. Okay. I don't think there's something so different between Romulus and South Seneca that the administration of education is going to be a varied and unique thing. I don't see how consolidation of administration is not, I mean, like the BOCES model works. Wayne Finger Lakes BOCES, that helps to save a lot of money when you consolidate certain functions. It doesn't mean you lose your autonomy on a neighborhood level if you still have some, you know, local access and control. But, I mean, come on. I mean, how many curriculum supervisors do you need if you're teaching a standardized curriculum in a place 30 miles from the next place? I don't know. I am not an education expert. I'm not an expert on anything. So what am I even talking about? But those are just my thoughts.
And I think what this sort of sheds light on is just how complicated the whole thing is. None of it's easy. None of these solutions are easy. We're not saying any of them are. They're all going to take a lot of work. But I think getting some of these numbers in front of people, sort of waking them up to what reality is in their community, because we've seen enough stories about people leaving New York State.
Yeah.
We don't need to talk about population loss anymore. It's been happening year after year after year, sometimes
now,
twice a year,
apparently. What do we do about it? Yeah.
Like school districts, there's a piece of the data that we haven't really looked at before. So let's look at it. Let's figure out what we can do there.
Right.
We have a reader question that I want to end on, a topic that I planned on talking about anyway. This one came from Ryan in Farmington. What do you guys make of the veto power proposal put forward by Senator Rich Funky? Did you see it?
I did see it.
What do you make of it? Thoughts, comments, concerns?
I think it's just a PR move. It sounds to me like a referendum, which already exists. And I don't like the idea that legislators should not legislate. And the idea that anytime there's a tax spending bill, it would have to go back to people to vote up or down, it seems ridiculous to me, because state legislators get paid a decent amount of money to get good information and to ostensibly make good decisions. And if we think they're making bad decisions, we replace them, or we should. That's the way it should work. I don't know why in the world somebody thinks that what we should do is go back and have another vote, which, just news alert in case he didn't realize this, although he should, holding votes costs money. So whatever cost savings you might get from voting down these tax proposals is going to be at least partially spent by gearing up all these polling places again. But the idea that somehow people need to double check the work of their elected officials by coming out and voting on stuff instead of just holding their elected officials to account, like, to me, this just seems like a way of legislators avoiding responsibility for the work that needs to be done to run the state. That's my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, can I say that I like it?
Yeah.
I like it. I like it a lot, actually.
I respect that. Tell me why you like it. Maybe you'll change my mind. What am I missing?
So the referendum rule exists, but it exists on a very narrow, in a very narrow scope. My hope with something like this would that it would be a little more expansive, and it would do two things. One, it would hold people accountable and sort of, you know, at that point, you really have no one else to blame but yourself. If you're random voter Joe who didn't vote in the last election, and there were 10 different proposals on the back of the ballot that really were consequential to your checkbook.
Right.
But then also it creates the need for a little bit of knowledge to be instilled in that voter. They have to, all of a sudden, the voter has an interest in that election. They have a real interest in that election. They don't just have an interest on whether they're affiliated with a certain party or not, but they actually have an interest based on what issues are up, what actual legislative issues are up to become law. I think if serving as another check and balance in the system, I think given where we are, mm-hmm. and given how unrealistic it feels, especially to the cynic in me, that we ever get to a place where politicians are working for the right reasons, or enough politicians are working for the right reasons to do the right things, I don't think we ever get there. It just doesn't seem reasonable at this point. So to that end, I like this. I think this is a necessary evil. Yeah, it will cost more money. Yes, it will become a little bit problematic. But you know what? I think it also could be fixed in a lot of ways, because how much more would it cost to have, instead of just two or three meaningless propositions on the back of a ballot, to have a dozen or two dozen things that are actually important and consequential to people who own businesses, people who actually have an interest in these things, and not just in a, how do you feel about this? Because right. That's the kind of proposition that drives me up a wall.
Yeah.
How do you feel about this? Because I remember marijuana legalization was a ballot proposition a few years ago, or a couple years ago maybe, or at least it was talked about as one, and it had absolutely no meaning. It had absolutely no... carried no weight at all. It's pointless. If you want New York State to be a pro marijuana state, elect people and they'll pass legislation. That proposition is not a piece of legislation. So that's kind of the thing in my mind. It's an opportunity to get people really engaged, really, really, really engaged. Now that said, I don't believe that this will pass. I don't believe that this piece of legislation will make it through, because I don't think Democrats will support it. I don't think the governor will sign it. I don't think he will, Democrat or Republican, I don't think Governor Cuomo will sign any bill into law that would limit his authority as governor.
Well, I think you're probably right about that. I mean, he can't even sign this anti-incinerator bill, which I don't understand. Why is that languishing?
And I love it, because it keeps being talked about as this, well, he's waiting for the right time because he's got to schedule things, because he has to have your moment in the sun, right? You have to have your, you have to have that moment where you go, you stand at the podium in front of the lake. They're probably waiting until everything around Seneca Lake is really nice and green. Then they can go there.
Green with harmful stand in front algal of the, blooms.
Stand in front of the those. I Heart yeah. New yeah. York sign.
Yeah, I mean, I can see what you're saying about this, but I have to say, in this current political environment, I am on edge and on the lookout for gaslighting. And I feel like that's what this proposal is, because you don't want something vague, okay? You don't want the proposition to say, hey, do you want better funding for schools? Should we spend money that way? You want the nuts and bolts, which is what he's proposing, right? We would get the nuts and bolts tax increase questions, and we would have to vote on them. So now, I mean, I am not an expert in municipal finance or state finance. I have to talk only about the big policy issues. Like, yes, I think schools need more money, and yes, I think it should be funded differently. I don't know that I would feel prepared to go in and say, we should take X amount of money from the state treasury and spend it on these line items. I think that's what I elected people to look at. You know, why don't they just quit then? And we'll do everything by referendum. So I understand that that is hyperbole. It's not, I've gone immediately to the bottom of the slippery slope with that. But I'm just saying, for me, it sounds like a way for people to say, well, if you don't want higher taxes, you should have gotten out to vote. And to a certain extent, that's a valid criticism, but I think it is a criticism of voting for elected officials, not for voting on an actual spending plan. I just feel like that is the average New Yorker just needs to live their life and pay attention to electing people who share their values and know how to put those values into practice, to then be the micromanagers of what those people pass, to me just seems like an opportunity for these guys to pass the buck.
Just pay attention, people. That's all it takes.
Well, that's true. That needs across the board. That's been our underlying thread.
That's it. That's all I've got.
Now I feel like we're ending on a sad note. Things
it
can
isn't.
Change. This is the message. If people pay attention and get involved, things will change. It's not a lost cause.
And there you have it. Hey, as always, thanks for listening. Look for The Debrief on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. I will be back next Friday. Until then, stay tuned to FingerLakes1.com for the latest headlines from around the region.